Good morning and welcome. My name is Robert Putnam, and it is my pleasure to welcome you to the Monadnock Summer Lyceum with today's guest speaker, Marjorie Hines. Please join me in thanking our pianist this morning, Robert Pettigrew. For many years, the Monadnock Summer Lyceum has been bringing outstanding world-class speakers to the Monadnock region, serving as a catalyst to inform, engage, and inspire an active citizenry on local, national, and global issues. We hope you will give us feedback on today's program on the blue cards found in the pew in front of you and join our mailing list. You can either mail the blue card to us or drop the card in one of the glass donation bowls alone or with your contribution to the Monadnock Lyceum. The Monadnock Summer Lyceum is supported entirely through contributions from our audience members. We deeply appreciate your donations, which may be placed in any of the glass donation bowls. Our speaker today is Marjorie Hines, a civil liberties lawyer, writer, teacher, and author of 5 prize-winning books on civil liberties, including Cutting the Mustard, Affirmative Action, and the Nature of Excellence, Sex, Sin, and Blasphemy, A Guide to America's Censorship Wars, Not in Front of the Children, Indecency, Censorship, and the Innocence of Youth, Priests of Our Democracy, the Supreme Court, Academic Freedom, and the Anti-Communist Purge. This most recent book tells of the teachers and professors who resisted the anti-communist witch hunt of the early 1950s, those who collaborated, and those whose battles led to landmark Supreme Court decisions. Ms. Hines has been a nationally prominent civil liberties lawyer for nearly 4 decades. She founded and directed the ACLU's Art Censorship Project and was the founding director of the Free Expression Policy Project. Educated at Cornell and Harvard Law School, she has taught in law schools from Boston College, Florida State, UC San Diego, Tufts University, American University of Paris, and currently NYU. Each of Ms. Hines' books combines vivid stories of actual court cases with profound reflections on the evolution of civil liberties in America today. So we are in for a treat as she speaks to us today on Sex Wars to Red Scare, A Civil Liberties Odyssey.
Thanks for coming on this beautiful day, and thanks especially to the Monadnock Summer Lyceum for honoring me with this invitation. As Bob mentioned, I call this talk A Civil Liberties Odyssey. Now, you may think that's a little presumptuous. After all, I didn't have to battle a giant cyclops like the hero Odysseus did in Homer's Odyssey, or resist the seductive songs of the sirens. But I did, in my civil liberties career, have to navigate between a rock and a whirlpool, that wonderful Homeric metaphor for difficult decisions that we have to make in life. So, luckily for all of us, my Odyssey is only 3 chapters, not the 24 chapters of Homer's. So, without further ado, here's chapter 1. It's actually just a prologue, which I call A Novice in the New Left. So I guess it all started at Wingate High School in Brooklyn for me when I began to buy Joan Baez records and joined the Folk Song Club. Now, some of you may remember that in the early 60s, folk singing was a political statement. So we were in favor of civil rights, we were against the bomb, we were for peace. By the time I got to college at Cornell, things had escalated. People were getting killed in the South, both black and white, for trying to register African Americans to vote. And the gruesome body count of the war in Vietnam was escalating. My little pacifist-oriented SDS group at Cornell, SDS was once a pacifist organization, organized a We Won't Go contingent, a draft resistance contingent for a big anti-Vietnam War march in April 1967. Pretty tame stuff, I guess, considering how the New Left, at least segments of the New Left, became quite violent just a few years later. Well, unlike some of my New Left companions in civil rights and anti-war protests, I was not what was called a red diaper baby. My parents were liberals, but far from activists. Hence, I didn't know what people were talking about when they would say, well, we're not going to make the mistakes of the old left. I'd never heard of the old left. It wasn't in any of my American history books. I didn't know what it was. It turned out that in its brief lifespan, the new left, you may remember, some of you, made plenty of mistakes of its own. And its destruction, I think, was no doubt aided and abetted by surveillance and provocateurs and dirty tricks by J. Edgar Hoover's FBI. But the new left was also hindered by a lack of historical memory, a void where institutions of radical reform and dissent had once been. These institutions had been destroyed, I later learned, by the political repression that is today, somewhat inaccurately, summed up by the term McCarthy era. And I say inaccurately because the loyalty programs and blacklists that characterized the post-World War II political repression of the left began long before Senator Joe McCarthy appeared on the scene and lasted well after he disappeared from the scene. But I'm getting ahead of my story. That's for Chapter 3. In any event, the new left collapsed so fast that I had plenty of time to read up on the history of earlier political dissent in the United States. I became fascinated by the role that the Supreme Court, supposedly the disinterested defender of constitutional values like free speech, should have played but conspicuously failed to play in stopping or even slowing the political repression that swept over the country in the late 1940s and early 50s. Well, we've gone from the Folk Song Club at Wingate High School to the Supreme Court pretty fast. That was quite an odyssey. Suffice it to say that at some point during the reading and thinking I did in the early 1970s, I fell in love with the Bill of Rights, and especially the First Amendment. I thought the courts could do better than they had during the McCarthy era, and by then the courts actually were doing better. Public interest in civil rights law seemed a good, noble way to spend one's life and maybe even earn a living at the same time. So in 1975, I started law school. Okay, Chapter 2, which I call The Politics of Sex. After law school and a few detours, I landed my dream job at the ACLU of Massachusetts. A decade later, I moved to New York City and came to the national ACLU, the American Civil Liberties Union, to head up a new art censorship project. Now, this was the early 90s. It was the era of the Moral Majority, the American Family Association, and a politician named Jesse Helms, fulminating on the floor of the United States Senate against a little federal agency called the National Endowment for the Arts for funding what he called blasphemous or indecent art. And on top of these threats to arts funding were actual criminal prosecutions in the early 90s for the crime of obscenity. Prosecutions against a rap music group in Florida, a music store owner who sold some records that were considered obscene, and in Ohio, against a contemporary art museum and its director for showing the work of the photographer Robert Mapplethorpe. So we're talking about criminal prosecutions. I was about to get a fast education in the politics of censorship, especially censorship of art, entertainment, and information on the subject of sex. I know, a moment ago I was talking about the new left and the old left and the Supreme Court, but I hope you won't be too disappointed if I have to spend a few minutes talking about sex, which, after all, Justice William Brennan once called a great and mysterious motive force in human life and a subject of absorbing interest to mankind through the ages. That's from a Supreme Court decision. So, as you probably won't be surprised to learn, there is a big strain of Puritanism in the Anglo-American cultural and legal tradition. Art, literature, and information about sexual matters have, at least since the 19th century, been the consistent targets of government censorship. So as director of the ACLU's New Art Censorship Project in 1991, I found myself confronting sex censorship in all of its infinite variety, from vaguely defined criminal laws against obscenity to endless attacks on books in school and public libraries, to the Federal Communications Commission's bans on indecent speech on radio and television. Anybody remember the 7 dirty words you couldn't say on the airwaves? I won't say them because this is going to be broadcasted. But that ban still exists. In my work at the ACLU, I soon discovered that the justification for a great many sex censorship laws and rules was the presumed but largely unexamined assumption that we needed to protect children from bad or corrupting ideas and adolescents from their own hormones. The result, after 7 years in the trenches battling over these issues, was my book Night in Front of the Children, which Bob mentioned, Indecency, Censorship, and the Innocence of Youth, and I understand copies are conveniently available back at the reception. So Not in Front of the Children is an exploration of how this harmful to minors rationale for censorship has evolved to produce not only our current obscenity laws and indecency laws, but the bowdlerization of books, literary classics in our schools, and gross distortions in what passes for sex education in our classrooms. So I'll share with you one story from these sex censorship battles. It begins in a small school district in Kansas. In 1993, a gay rights group donated copies of a novel called Annie on My Mind to school libraries in the district of Olathe, Kansas. Annie's a teenage lesbian love story, not sexually explicit, but certainly gay positive. There were vociferous protests. The superintendent, under pressure from school board members, caved into the protests and ordered all copies of the book removed. The reasons were not subtle. As one school board member put it, he considered homosexuality, quote, a mental disorder similar to schizophrenia, and felt that Annie on My Mind, quote, glorified a homosexual lifestyle that is sinful in the eyes of God. We've come a fair way since 1993, but there are still those sentiments out there. Another board member felt that the book promoted, quote, the homosexual lifestyle, which does not meet the basic standards of the community. Now, this sort of thing happens all the time in school districts all across America, and part of the reason is that our public education system is very decentralized. So states have primary responsibility for educational curriculum, and most cities and towns have local school boards as well, some appointed, some elected. But rarely, if ever, is there a requirement that the school board members actually know anything about education. So school book, textbook curriculum and library, school library, books, videos, DVDs, and so forth become easy targets for political crusades by pressure groups, local pressure groups, and by that I don't only mean those that we might consider on the right end of the political spectrum. Pressure groups, that anti-racist classic Huckleberry Finn, for example, has been a target of some civil rights groups for many years because of its use of the N-word in recounting accurately the dialogue between Huck and other characters. So in most school censorship incidents, like the one I described in Kansas, there's no significant opposition to the book removal. But once in a while, a group gets together and wants to challenge it and looks for legal help. And, not surprisingly, they often call the ACLU. That's what happened in Olathe, Kansas. A group of students, parents, and even a few teachers wanted to bring a legal challenge to the censorship of Annie on My Mind. Now, the law, when it comes to school censorship, was murky in 1993, and it remains murky today. Students and teachers don't have First Amendment rights to read, study, or teach what they want. Ordinarily, school boards, administrators, and state agencies make these choices. But a 1982 Supreme Court decision carved out an exception to this general rule of school board autonomy. If a text or library book removal is motivated by political ideology and unrelated to any legitimate educational concern, then it violates the First Amendment, rights of students to have access to diverse ideas. So far, so good, because in Olathe, Kansas, as we've seen, several school board members did not exactly conceal their ideological motives for removing Annie on My Mind. The ACLU took the case, with private law firm acting as lead attorneys, and I was the lucky ACLU staff lawyer working with them. But federal court litigation can be slow and complicated and costly and cumbersome. We lawyers racked up many hours in pretrial proceedings, so did the other side. By the time a school censorship case ends, the student plaintiffs are often not only out of high school, but out of college and graduate school, and sometimes they even have kids of their own. Well, after two grueling years and lots of filing of legal documents back and forth, we finally did get a very good court decision from the Federal District Court, ruling that the motives for the removal of Annie in My Mind were unconstitutional. So, victory for the good guys, right? By the way, I'm happy to be disagreed with on this or anything else in this talk. I look forward to having discussion of some of these issues. They're not easy issues during our Q&A. But to finish my Kansas saga, the school district's lawyers told us they intended to appeal from our favorable court decision. This would prolong the time, cost, and uncertainty for several more years. This threat may have been just a bargaining chip, but if so, it worked. I was overruled on this, but the plaintiffs and their lawyers in Kansas decided to settle the case with an agreement that the book would be back in school libraries, as the judge had ordered, but it would not be on the shelves. Instead, it would only be made available and checked out to students with their parents' permission. So much for the teenagers who might be going through figuring out their sexual orientation and weren't quite ready to come out to mom and dad. So the Kansas case was a lesson for me that even victories in the courts don't necessarily translate into total wins in everyday life. True, we got a very good court decision. It's a precedent, it's on the books, a case that others can look to in future school censorship controversies. But court decisions don't do much to change political attitudes, and school officials, I fear, will continue to ban books, films, and other materials unless political attitudes change. Okay, now on to Chapter 3, Priests of Our Democracy. That's the other book, also available, I hope. So this actually has a connection to the sex wars, especially the ones involving school censorship. Because as I worked on these cases, I found myself going back again and again to a line of Supreme Court decisions about academic freedom. These decisions were a response, although a much belated response, to the political repression I've already mentioned, which swept the U.S. in the years after World War II. Inquisitions by legislative committees, blacklists, criminal trials for advocating subversive ideas, and sweeping loyalty programs for state and federal employees were all challenged in the courts with little, if any, success in the 1950s. Then in the early 60s, gradually, cautiously, incrementally, the Supreme Court began to strike down loyalty programs, but usually on fairly narrow technical grounds. It wasn't until 1967, in a case called Harry Kayishian et al., that means the other plaintiffs, versus the Board of Regents of the State of New York, that the court rejected wholesale the basic premises of loyalty programs for employment. And no surprise, it was our friend Justice Brennan who wrote the majority opinion. And because the Kayishian case involved teachers, actually professors at the University of Buffalo, Brennan had something to say about academic freedom. And the most famous lines from the Kayishian case are, "Academic freedom," Brennan wrote, "is a special concern of the First Amendment, which does not tolerate laws that cast a pall of orthodoxy over the classroom." I found myself quoting this line about a pall of orthodoxy over the classroom pretty often in my briefs at the ACLU in school censorship cases. So ultimately, I decided to write a book about academic freedom and how it became a special concern of the First Amendment. And writing Priests of Our Democracy was a way for me connecting up my youthful questions about the demise of the old left and the void it left in American politics with my law school engendered erudition about Supreme Court decision making. But a funny thing happened on the way to the printers. My book evolved from a primarily legal history to one that encompassed social and political struggles. In essence, the backstage story behind the court cases. Here's how it happened. Wind the tape back to 1952. The U.S. Senate Internal Security Subcommittee is in New York City looking for communists, ex-communists, fellow travelers, or anybody else who might once have participated in a pro-labor May Day parade or signed a petition sponsored by a suspect communist front group, as the term was. The committee's special focus was on the New York City schools, and particularly the four campuses that made up the city's public, then free, higher education system, Brooklyn College, Queens College, Hunter College, and the City College of New York. So among the witnesses subpoenaed by the committee were two popular professors from Queens College, one in economics, the other in English literature. Both refused to testify about their political beliefs and associations. Within weeks, they were fired. A junior at Queens College named Harry Kayishian joined a student protest group. And as Harry told me later, he'd been apolitical up to that point, mostly interested in chasing girls and in his humor column in the college newspaper. But he was incensed by the sudden arbitrary dismissal of two much-loved and highly skilled professors. Okay, fast forward 11 years. Harry is now a young instructor in English at the University of Buffalo, which has just become part of the State University of New York SUNY system, therefore now a public university. So everybody on staff is suddenly required to sign an affidavit attesting that they're not communists, or if they ever had been, they reported this fact to the university president, and furthermore, they were required by this oath to certify that they were in compliance with all provisions of a sweeping state loyalty program for public employees, a program in which everybody essentially had to be investigated. School chairmen were required to report on the political beliefs of teachers, principals on the political beliefs of chairmen, and superintendents on the political beliefs or anything else suspicious about principals. And the law disqualified from employment any person who had uttered, quote, subversive statements or distributed subversive literature or promoted revolutionary ideas. The whole faculty actually was up in arms, very incensed by this loyalty oath. But as it was a condition of employment and this state university administration was not budging, not surprisingly, most people felt they needed to keep their jobs. Harry and four other faculty members refused to sign the oath and decided to bring a legal challenge to the New York loyalty law. But hardly anybody thought they would win. Digress briefly for an anecdote. I don't know if anybody here has heard of the now deceased, but in his time quite famous, left-wing lawyer Leonard Boudin. So I don't see hands raised, but he was very well-known and quite courageous about taking tough cases. One of Harry's co-plaintiffs wrote to Leonard Boudin asking for legal help, and Boudin wrote back, you know, you're not going to win this case. And that was the general opinion among the legal community. Primarily because 11 years before, in 1952, the Supreme Court had upheld this particular New York State law called the Feinberg Law. It was typical of anti-subversive loyalty laws in states throughout the country. And that 1952 case was called Adler versus Board of Education. It had been brought by teachers, parents, taxpayers, all around New York. Court's analysis in the Adler case was not subtle or sophisticated. Basically, the majority opinion said, if you don't like the terms of employment, you can find a job somewhere else. But, now Brandon wasn't on the court yet, but William O. Douglas, that iconoclastic libertarian, was on the court. And in these days, in the early 50s, Black and Douglas dissenting was like a chorus that you heard over and over again. Douglas wrote a brilliant dissent in the Adler case. He pointed out the perils of a system that investigates political loyalty. He said the law would, quote, raise havoc with academic freedom, first time that term was used by a Supreme Court justice. Teachers would, quote, tend to shrink from any association that stirs controversy. The school system would become a spying project where the principals became detectives, the students, the parents, the community became informers. Why, for example, said Douglas, he gave a list of examples, why was the history teacher so openly hostile to Franco Spain? Who heard overtones of revolution in the English teacher's discussion of the grapes of wrath? Where suspicion fills the air, Douglas wound up, and holds scholars in line for fear of their jobs, there can be no exercise of the free intellect. And he wound up with this metaphor, which you may find a bit familiar. A pall is cast over the classrooms, Douglas writes in 1952. But this is only a dissent. And despite occasional departures from Cold War orthodoxy, the Supreme Court since 1952 had consistently reaffirmed its ruling in this Adler case. But by the time Kayishian versus Board of Regents gets to the Supreme Court, and the decision comes out in January of 1967, they did win their case, although by a very narrow 5-4 vote. And Justice Brennan's majority opinion borrowed that line about a pall of orthodoxy over the classroom from that dissent by Douglas 15 years earlier in the Adler case. At the University of Buffalo, there was dancing in the halls. Harry Kayishian, who'd been fired 1963 for refusing to sign the oath, was jubilant too. He called the legal challenge his revenge on the 50s. So, starting out as a student at Queens College, he had his revenge on the 50s. By the way, he had a long, successful career as an English professor at Fairleigh Dickinson University, where he specialized in Shakespeare. He lent me his yellowed notes from the Queens College student newspaper while I was working on the book. Incidentally, the title, Priests of Our Democracy, comes from a Supreme Court decision by Justice Felix Frankfurter, and it doesn't refer to religious priests or Supreme Court justices. It refers to teachers. Frankfurter said that teachers are, quote, the priests of our democracy, because it's their job to foster those habits of open-mindedness and critical inquiry which alone make for responsible citizens, end quote. In other words, academic freedom is not about giving special free speech rights to smart people with PhDs. It's about preparing young citizens to think critically so they can make sensible decisions at the polls and on their school boards and in their town meetings. That is, so that they can make democracy work. I know this sounds a bit utopian, especially in our age of very expensive electoral campaigns, but that's the basic idea of academic freedom. That's what teachers are supposed to do. That basic idea is under a lot of pressure today, as I recount in the closing chapters of Priests of Our Democracy. Recent Supreme Court decisions have seemed to question the basic premises of the Kayesian case. They talk about academic freedom, if it exists at all under the First Amendment, as something that belongs to the university as a whole rather than to individual teachers or professors. And on campuses, there are any number of conflicts all the time about free speech and its limits. Indeed, the very structure of higher education has changed in the past few decades. The quest for corporate funding, the bloating of administrative ranks, and the shrinking of tenured and tenure-track faculty have put academic freedom on precarious ground. But that's a subject for another lecture. And anyway, I don't want to end on a gloomy note. I can't make any predictions about the future of academic freedom or about art censorship, except that it's never-ending. But I can say, and this is important given that pressures of this kind are never-ending, that in our society we have a sturdy community of free speech activists, librarians, I'd put them first, teachers, artists, sex educators, the ACLU, and many others. And I consider myself lucky to have been a member of this tribe for many years. So I'm going to close now. Thanks for listening to my odyssey, and I hope you have some good questions. Thank you. Should I stay here?
Yes.
Okay.